Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet, by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes and this is The Unexplained. Thank you very much for being part of my show, and thank you very much for all of the nice comments you made about the coverage of the cruise with Marella. If you were one of the people that I met there, I hope you had a great time. I know that you did. You kept telling me. And I hope you had a safe trip home. And maybe I'll see you again there one of these days. Who knows? Who knows? Thanks for all the emails. Very good to receive them. Always look at the emails as they come in. Even if I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, I still look at the emails. And all points noted. If your email requires a response, please just write in it, reply required. And if you haven't heard back from me, let me know.
What else is there to say?
Weather. The weather today is weird for November. It is the middle of November. It's 17 degrees Celsius, 63 Fahrenheit in the suburban part of London where I am. It's a little grey, but there's some brightness creeping through. Feels like a spring day. I might even go out for a bike ride later. That's how good it is. But when I was a kid in Liverpool, November days were always crispy, cold, icy, foggy. Not so now, by the looks of it. So that's the weather report. Thanks to Adam, my webmaster, for his continuing hard work on getting the shows out to you. If you would like to make a donation to the show to allow it to continue in its present form, then please do that. Go to the website, theunexplained.tv, follow the link, and you can send me a donation, PayPal donation from there. And if you have done that recently, thank you very, very much from the bottom of my heart. It's very good of you to do that. I realize these are hard times, so being able to do that and willing to do that at this time is a wonderful thing. Thank you. My Facebook page, the official Facebook page of The Unexplained with Howard Hughes, and no other similar Facebook page, is still there. Check it out. If you want to leave a comment, please do. And it is always there for you to observe and be part of. The official Facebook page of The Unexplained with Howard Hughes. That's enough taking care of business. Guest on this edition, Paul Sinclair. The man behind the Truth Proof Books did his first interview on The Unexplained a few years ago. Now is an international phenomenon. Very proud of Paul, and always will be. So we're going to get to him in just a second. Thank you very much for continuing to be my friend and for continuing to fuel The Unexplained with Howard Hughes and be part of this international family. My feet are just touching the ground after the cruise. It was an amazing experience. I was full of trepidation before I went, and I came back completely converted. But that's another story for another time. All right, let's get to East Yorkshire now, the home of Paul Sinclair, the man behind the Truth Proof Books. Paul, thank you very much for coming back on my show.
Well, thank you very much for asking me, Howard. And as always, it's a pleasure, and I hope we can share a few bits of information with the listeners today.
How have the last few months been for you? Because you're a guy who never stops.
Absolutely full on. You're quite right in what you say. I mean, I'm always up at 5 a.m. catching up on emails, replying to messages, and odd times I'm out early hours as well, you know, and it never stops. And it literally is I've said it loads of times, it's a full-time job. I mean, I'm still looking at emails and doing things when I'm supposed to be sat relaxing at 10:30, 11 at night if I'm at home. So yeah, it's full on.
And you know, something happened when we started doing those podcasts first, I think maybe 4 years ago now, I've lost track of time, but people started to contact you at the beginning through me, and then they came to you directly with their own stories. I guess that's happening even more so now.
Absolutely. It really is. You know, like you said, people were contacting you. You were passing information on to me and various, ways of contacting these people, be it via phone or email. And yeah, I get absolutely loads of information sent to me now, so much so I always reply, but it's overwhelming. There's literally loads. We got some historic sightings that, please don't ask me to talk about them today because I've not fully digested them. We've put them on the website, and I will be talking to this guy who sent me his family's sightings and in an email a few days ago. And brilliant. I mean, some of the sightings, you know, are from all parts of the United Kingdom, but that's the way it's going. Originally, Howard, you know, I were talking about East and North Yorkshire, but everything's kind of expanding. I mean, primarily, I'm still focusing on my areas of interest because these are the places that I can reach within I don't know, 30 minutes, in some instances 10 minutes, because I'm only a few hundred yards from Bridlington seafront. So I will be concentrating on eastern North Yorkshire, but can't ignore the other sightings that come in from all around the UK and other parts of the world. It's fabulous.
It was interesting how it spread. You started in your own area, then it moved down towards Grimsby Way, which is slightly south of you, and then down towards a little bit of East Anglia. So it's kind of spread out from there.
It has, and I think trust's a big thing. You know, I'm no different to you or many people who will be listening to this, but you're only as good as your word. And if you're giving people your word that you're not going to talk about these things if they don't want, then you've got to stick by that and not trash somebody's confidence or trust just because you think you've sat on you've received a sensational story. Do you know, Howard, I said on a podcast, my own podcast, the Truth Proof one, the other day, I've got bits of information bouncing about in my head. Some of it I wish I didn't know, because some of it's quite sensitive. But there's other stuff. There's some stories or accounts, people's experiences that they've just wanted to share, but not wanted me to share, and I haven't done. And that's kind of frustrating, but that's basically what I'm getting at. That's my point.
Otherwise, you lose credibility if you don't respect people. I'm just wondering, with some of those stories, you know, sometimes people worry unnecessarily about what it will be like for them if they come out and tell the story. You know, one of the examples of a story that remained untold for years was the story of the captain of the Morella Explorer, the ship that we did the cruise on. And he had a story that he told us in the last edition of my podcast that he hadn't told publicly ever, and he may never have told it before he told it to me, and there was no problem when we did that, and you know, nobody would ridicule anybody for having a sighting as credible as that one. But people do worry, and I guess part of your job might be to say, well, look, if ever I wanted to write this down or would like to, would you think about it? And you know, we could even change your name or whatever.
I always say that I'll leave it open. Usually you'll be receiving an email or getting a telephone conversation. I don't ever want my name used in connection with what I'm about to tell you or words to that effect. And I always respect that. But then I will sort of follow it up with, well, if I do write about it, if I change your name, would you be comfortable with that? And if they still come back with no, I've just wanted to share this with you, just to let you know, because, I don't know, I've heard you talking about all of these accounts. I've heard you talking about your own experiences in, on podcasts and read the book Night People. And it's kind of made me realise that I'm not actually, I don't mean myself, I mean the person talking to me, that I'm not actually going mad. That other people are experiencing these things. And you've just touched on the cruise, Howard, and this, I can only touch on this, but I'd love to talk about it at some future point in time. I'd need to do a little bit more research. Years ago, I was contacted by a man called, and he'll not mind me using his name, Roger Gilbert, who lives in Bridlington, and he was a musician on cruise ships. The reason I want to talk about it at another point is I can get the name of the ship and I can get more details. But one particular ship that he worked on extensively, and I think we're going to be going back to the 1980s, because this guy's retired now and, you know, he's, I think he's in his 70s, might be a little bit older. And there were strange happenings in one cabin on the ship. And it's I find it fascinating because it wasn't in a particular location, because you've heard me talk about location being key when you get a lot of paranormal activity happening in certain places. This is all parts of the sea when this cruise ship was out, you know. And it was a cabin that the musicians used. It wasn't the public. It was, you know, for the just one used by people who worked the ship. But people reported seeing aliens inside the room.
Aliens?
White aliens inside the room. Roger told me about this, and he'd had experiences of it himself, or similar strange phenomena in and around this area of the ship. So it's something I'm going to have a little dig into it. It's years ago now, and it's the last thing on my mind today, if I'm being truthful, but you mentioned the cruise ship. And I thought, blimey heck, yeah, there's that story there or that account which I've spoke to Roger about several times and he's given me information, but I've not written it up in any great detail. It's such a strange one because I'm thinking, location doesn't apply here, and why would one particular part of a boat, of a ship, be of interest to unexplained phenomena? Why would unexplained phenomena present in a certain cabin on a ship in any random place as they're out cruising?
Well, you expect nothing much to happen when you're at sea because it's very quiet most of the time, and that just isn't so. And that story that the captain of the Mirella Explorer told me about, the lights zipping right over the top of the ship, like just 100 feet or so above the ship, at tremendous velocity, totally silent, is an amazing story. And I'm sure that there are many more stories from people who go to sea, but we don't get to hear them quite as much as we get to hear them from commercial pilots. Well, so that's interesting.
Well, as you'll know better than me, you can remember Radio 270, was it? The boat that rocked the Oceania.
That was just for my listener here and for the ones in America. We had, because the BBC had a monopoly on radio in the 60s, that was broken by a radio station called Radio Caroline. There was another one called Radio London. There were lots of others. They were on ships and they played 24/7, 365 pop music until the government stopped them. And there was a wonderful one on 270 metres medium wave off Filey, I think.
It were off Flamborough Head, Filey and Bridlington.
And it was, it created some stars like Paul Burnett, who I know very well and went to work on Radio 1. And they had some terrible weather to deal with in the North Sea. What happened on that ship?
Well, I'll drop a few names, and I can't remember where they fit into the story. There were a guy called Chris Dannett, Paul Rusling, and they worked on the Oceania during the period of time that you're talking about, Howard. And one of them, I can't remember who now, told me that they had a UFO sighting whilst on the boat. And it was a Coast Guard that told me about it, and then I contacted, I think it was Paul Rusling, and he helped me look into it a little bit. And the Coast Guards in those days, I think, I can't remember the year, but you might be able to help me. Are we 1960s here?
Well, the era, the ship, I think, was on the air from, I think, 64, 65 to 67.
Yeah, well, I think this will be about 1966, 67. And the Coast Guard at Hornsey, they said, they probably wouldn't do it now, but they said that they used to listen to the radio whilst, I don't know, working in the station. And a UFO report came up whilst listening from the boat. They didn't get it called to the Hornsey Coast Guard. They were actually listening to it, and the people on board the ship were saying that there's a huge sphere of light just above the boat. It could be seen from the from Hull, the lightship. I think, you know, the lightship in Hull could see this thing as well. And once again, another sighting that got backed up and verified by the people who worked the boat at the time. And there was one member who, I'm trying to say it was Chris Dannett, and he wrote a book and included it in the book. So, another sighting just off the coast of Bridlington, but boat-related. I mean, when I were looking into the Wilsthorpe incident, which is just a few miles up the coast from where I'm sat right now, I spoke to a retired Coast Guard who lives close to Wilsthorpe. I won't say his name. And he lives within sight of the flats where the couple saw the alleged UFOs over the sea. And I were asking questions, just doing a bit of, not so much door knocking, because it's a strange thing to knock on somebody's door and ask them about. But if I saw people about and I said, I'm in area, I'm just trying to pick a bit of information up, and do you recall anything unusual being seen in the sky? I know these are weird things to ask people, but if you're not going to get the answers unless you ask. So I told this guy, turned out he was a retired Coast Guard. I think he was for Bridlington. And he said he'd seen nothing. He said, however, I used to be in the Navy, the Royal Navy, and I have seen a sea monster. Last thing I expected him to say, a sea serpent. So he explained to me that as a young man, he were working as an engineer he said, and we were in the South China Sea on this Royal Navy vessel. He said, and I don't know, during the early hours, he said, these ships had huge chimneys or funnels, and there was a ladder on the inside you could climb up. Anybody connected with the Navy, if I'm saying this wrong, it's only because I don't understand the sort of workings of these things. I'm not trying to be an expert on this, but he said on a night we weren't supposed to do, but occasionally we'd cut, there's a big gantry around the top of these funnels, or the funnels, aren't they? He said we'd just climb up and we'd just view the night. We weren't supposed to do it, but we would. He says, and it's the South China Sea. He said, it's a moonlit night, and as we're up there, we can see the reflection of the moon on the water. He says, and there's this huge serpent type thing swimming like a snake on the surface of the water. He said it was as long as the ship. He said, and it just sailed, you know, just sort of swam away into the night. And he's quite sure of what he said. I mean, I went asking questions about a UFO related event at Willsthorpe, and I got this unusual story. So they're out there, you know. My dad's brother was a second officer in the Merchant Navy, London Overseas Transport, I think it was, and quite an high ranking position. And he talks about, and I think this is a natural phenomena, but he talked once again, South China Sea, about being brought up onto the deck and all the crew on watching these huge cartwheel shaped circles that were below the sea that were switching on and off and glowing in this orange and blue bioluminescence. I think this is not unique. I think it's been seen many times, and I think it's been, I don't know, I think it's some natural phenomena, some algae or something, you know, maybe in years gone by, people in sailing ships would have thought that was some kind of, I don't know, absolutely weird, out of this world happening that was occurring beneath the waves. He said, but these things were huge, absolutely lots bigger than the ship, and they'd switch off and then you'd see them lighting up in another part of the sea. And Andrew always, well, not always, but you know, if we get talking about things, he'd bring up the subject of the cartwheel shaped, and he said they were all like spoked, it were perfect in shape below the surface of the water in the South China Sea. He saw it once. So I'm wondering how many other people have seen things like that. I've spoke to fishermen off Flamborough who've talked about seeing strange lights under the sea.
And at the moment, of course, in the news, and it's being debated in Washington at the moment, as you know, politicians and other decision makers out there decide how much they are willing to tell us about the phenomenon, and whether the phenomenon in their belief has some extra-worldly capacity to it. You know, USOs, undersea, unidentified objects, unidentified submersible objects, very much in the news at the moment. So we can't ignore the fact that there is stuff going on in the sky that people are telling us about all the time, but there are also things happening at sea.
Well, what better place to go if you're an otherworldly intelligence and you want to be under the radar kind of thing? You know, I mean, I know that we've got technology that can detect things under the sea as well, but you know, I've seen lights under the sea off the surface off the coast of Bempton. 2017, myself and Bob Brown, we took pictures of it. I've said before, Bob took them on his mobile phone and they turned out better than on my Canon, which were a good camera. You know, and there's lots of reports. Ulrome, which is a few miles down the coast towards Hornsey, I've had three reports of green lights under the sea at Ulrome. And what we saw were white lights, and I don't know how far out they were. It's difficult to say. I'll jump to Ulrome in a moment. But you're looking at 18 to 22 miles from the cliff tops, depending on elevation and weather conditions, and these things must have been 2 or 3 miles out. And anybody who's showing me age here, anybody who remembers old dustbins, the old ones, the steel round ones, they looked about the size of dustbin lids, these white lights under the surface of the water, but they were clearly there. You know, it weren't some kind of... are they lights? Is that, or is it just foam or something? These were lights under the water, and there's lots of reports, as I say, further down the coast at Ulrome. And I talked about Wilsthorpe and September the 15th, 2009, and the circle of boomerang-shaped UFOs that the elderly couple saw from their flat.
Well, that was an amazing case. I mean, it wasn't only them, and the military were heavily involved in that one.
The military came the next day, Howard, and, you know, I was searching for information. I'd already received a telephone conversation with the elderly couple and then gone and met them. I met them, well, quite a lot of times, to be honest. And other people, they remember, bearing in mind, people listening to this, when I say the flats at Wilsthorpe, these are on the edge of the North Sea, and the 16 in just four blocks, and the 16 flats in total. And that's it. You've got nothing left and right of you for a considerable distance. It's pretty barren. And throughout 2009, I'd been documenting lots and lots of UFO-related information all around the area, to the point where I'd actually been parked at the back of Wilsthorpe, just off the main road in a lay-by. Nothing to do with what the elderly couple told me, because people were reporting UFOs, unexplained phenomena, in that area. One particular night, I was parked behind a police scientific investigation van, just my vehicle. Guy in the vehicle with me was called Peter Masters, and he's an electronics expert. He's helping us do some work on clifftops now regarding what we're looking into. You know, it's the 1.6 gigahertz that we're picking that signal up. But I'm rambling here. Let me carry on with
Wilsthorpe. No, that's interesting as well. But
yeah, well,
but carry on with the Wilsthorpe.
So this particular night, I mean, we parked at Waldgate. I realise I'm saying places here, people, that not many know, but you can Google these areas. And it looked over the entire area of Wilsthorpe, Fraysthorpe, Bridlington. You got a good overview, but it was quite misty. The only thing that passed me was a police scientific investigation van. We decided that we were going to drive down closer to the area. We didn't know Wilsthorpe was the key area at that time. The elderly couple only contacted me when I was writing the first book, and I put an advert in asking for information about strange events. So we parked up. A car followed us on the way down, and it's foggy, and there's just one car vehicle following us, and it's a pretty desolate road at that time of night. And there was a turn into a bungalow, a private property, and then about three quarters of a mile up the road, there's the pull-in, the lay-by, where we were going to go. I got it wrong and turned into the bungalow. Misty night, and I were in my works van with Peter. I put the van into reverse and realised the car that had followed us from Waldgate had stopped behind us on the road. That were unusual in itself. Yeah. And, you know, so I reversed out, pulled into the lay-by, and then the car just carried on going up the road. That was end of it. Whether it were following us, I don't know. I mean, anybody listening to this, you can form your own opinions. I think it probably was. Otherwise, why would it have stopped? So we pulled in at the lay-by. There's a van in the lay-by with us, and it's a police scientific investigation van. And it's got a big black, like half football on the roof that looked like a camera. Sat there in the darkness, quite uneventful, couldn't see anybody about. We didn't get out of our vehicle to see if there were anybody in the van. It's a police van. We're not going to go tapping on window. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. We didn't stay long. And then we went on his way. I dropped Peter off and I went home. The night was pretty uneventful. But it all sort of foretold after that, all of the information. I mean, the elderly couple claimed that they'd seen these things. These boomerang-shaped objects over the sea from their flats. And as I've said many times, you could go to the bottom of their garden and throw a stone into the sea at high tide. That's how close these properties are to the sea. And the next day, the military arrived. And I got a Freedom of Information request, and obviously they acknowledged that they were there. But we'd also got the bait diggers in Bridlington, the guys who dig bait and then sell it to the people who fish for, I don't know, plaice and cod off the harbour wall or go out on boat trips. Well, they obviously have to get mussels and clams and razorfish and lugworm. They have to get it somewhere, so they dig bait when tides are favourable. They'd already told me that they'd seen triangular-shaped objects entering the sea off Wilsthorpe around that time period. The night, we don't know the exact night, but either the few nights before the elderly couple saw these objects, or the same night they went to dig bait and were Well, it was afterwards because the military were there. The military stopped them during the night, asked them what they were doing. They said, well, we're bait diggers. We've come to sort of dig. They said, you're going nowhere. And they were armed and they marched them off the beach, told them they'd be getting removed. They didn't give them any specific threats, but they were very intimidating if they didn't get off the beach. Well, they did get off the beach, but they hung about and looked over the beach afterwards in the darkness. He said, and the beach had got military personnel with what looked like metal detectors moving about all over the beach. There's lots and lots to this, Howard, and I realise that this show that we're doing now hasn't got all the time to devote to it because we talk about lots of things. But yeah, Willsthorpe's an interesting case, and once again, lights under the sea. And we'll just jump then to this year, September the 27th, a dog walker, 9:15 approximately at night. And I think I've traced the witness. There'll be more to come from this. Claims that a triangle, all lit up, entered the sea off Willsthorpe. What's fascinating about this, we don't know how far out this thing was, so it could have been a mile out, it could have been 2 miles out, so the sea conditions would have been different. But as the bait diggers would tell you, if you put chest waders on, the sea is so flat, the beach there, that you could walk out several hundred yards and not go over your head. So what we're saying is when the elderly couple saw them on September the 15th, 2009, close in, and the bait diggers at that time in 2009 had said that they'd seen triangles entering the sea, it shouldn't have happened. It shouldn't have been possible. What they're saying contradicts everything that believe is possible.
Contradicts the physical reality, but then we know, because we've talked about such things before, physical reality can be transcended by some things if you are willing to suspend your disbelief for, you know, just half a second. And interesting, isn't it, that somebody reported, somebody independent, somebody not related to the original witnesses, we believe, reported something 13 years later.
Absolutely. And once again, I mean, not to the exact date, but we're looking at the elderly couple's sighting. If we're to believe that they saw it on the 14th, because we know the military came on the 15th, the Freedom of Information request that I put in, I made it as specific as I could. And I said between the 14th and the 18th of September 2009, they arrived on the 15th, at Willsthorpe. And once again, I'm looking at the 27th. Of September 2022. Not a lot of time between. I mean, is there some kind of relationship to the months and the weather conditions? It's I know we don't know these things, but it flags up again and again. June seems to flag up quite a lot in unexplained phenomena around Bempton and Flamborough, and it'd be interesting to learn if other researchers find similar things happening.
If indeed there is some kind of seasonal aspect to it, it would be interesting to know. As far as the military interest in this, though, I'm talking about Willsthorpe, which is a case, as you say, you could write an entire book about that now, and I think personally you should, or do a documentary about it. Has the military involvement, as far as we know, continued?
Not at Willsthorpe. They stayed a few days. And, you know, the Royal Yacht Club, and that sounds ever so grand, people, but and no disrespect to people at the Yacht Club, but my son-in-law had a catamaran there at the time of the incident. I didn't know any of this, you know, and we found out afterwards. And he was actually working in the compound when the military arrived. So what I'm saying is, because the Freedom of Information request said that it was all explosions and gunshots that were heard were all simulated, and everything, all rules had sort of been complied with as regards this military, top secret military exercise that were taking place. Well, they clearly not asked the yacht club for permissions or anything, in my opinion, because Kev, my son-in-law, were working in compound and he got removed and they requisitioned it and took it over. And there's a big porter cabin on the clifftops and they used that for several days. So that kind of does not ring true, should we say. And what's interesting is the reply that I got back is almost identical to what Cass Clark got back for Pen Turk.
That's the South Wales case, one of my previous podcasts. You'll hear all about that. That was bizarre. It involved strange lights and something, radiation, a military craft. There was a military exercise around there, but not actually there at the time. Very strange case. So we're either saying, aren't we, I think, you tell me if I'm not right, that the military are observing this because they know about it and when it's going to happen, or they are going to the scene of where these things have been reported because they want to know about it.
I think it could be a little bit of both there, Howard. And I don't know what kind of technology could detect this stuff, these occurrences. But definitely they arrive at the scene because they're wanting to observe or wanting to, I don't know, catch a glimpse of the phenomena for whatever reason that might be. On the 8th, which is a few days ago...
November the 8th, we're going to talk about some sightings, aren't we?
That's correct. Do you want me to talk about those now?
Well, yeah, I do, because I'm looking here. I've got on my computer screen here the Hull Daily Mail. Now, the Hull Daily Mail, as we both know, does a lot of this stuff. You've been featured in it, too.
That's correct.
This was mysterious flashing lights spotted, and this is not the only case recently that the Hull Daily Mail have reported, spotted in the sky over Hull. This is the HU5 area, which I'm guessing is not far from the centre of Hull. 6 p.m. Tuesday, November the 8th, and the paper says, total mystery to what the lights were. And I think you have some other connection with Bempton as well, which is not that far away.
That's correct. We're talking about 35 miles away. It's down the coast. You can actually see Hull on clear nights. So, you know, you see all the lights of it, and you can see even further. You can see down towards Salt End. But... this bit came up in the newspaper. Somebody highlighted it to me. But myself and Bob Brown, as people have heard me talk about Bob, we go all over the place. And we were going to change our pattern of going up to the clifftops or these locations. And we were going to go that particular night, 11 o'clock till about 1 or 2 in the morning. Once again, people, when somebody says, Paul, why do you see these things and other people don't? You've got to be in these places. Yeah, and then again, we can go for 6 months, people, and see nothing. You can go for a year and see nothing. You just know the potential in these areas is greater than most other places. Right, so jumping to it, we were going to go at that time later on, and I received a phone call from a guy called Adam, who was in Hunmanby. So you can see right down the coast from Bempton. And he said, Paul, he said, have you had any reports of strange lights or anything over the coast? I said, well, we've been going up for weeks and weeks and seen nothing, experienced nothing. He said, well, I'm at Hunmanby at the moment with my partner. Could be his wife, so apologies, Adam, if you listen to this. But not that that makes any difference. He said, I'm looking at 7 lights over the sea, and they look to be off Bempton and Speighton. 7 orange spheres. He says, but I've got binoculars on them. He says, and they're oval in shape. So he's looking at these spheres. Then he tells me that they've switched off and they've become 3. Instantly, there's 3.
So they merged, did he think?
I don't think they merge. I've seen them over the years. I've been watching these things for years and years, and you can't get camera on them quick enough. It's a difficult one. And when I said binoculars, I've got another sighting. Adam did not say binoculars. I'm looking at another sighting as well off Flamborough Head, which is very similar. So apologies for doing Adam a disservice there. He's looking at these things. He said he never even thought to try and film them with his phone. He's just glad that his wife or partner was with him to validate what he was looking at, so these bright orange spheres. And then he told me that they were over the top of the cliffs above in the air, but they just looked to be hanging above the cliffs in a row of 7. So I contacted Bob. I said, look, let's change his plans. I said, we're not forced to see anything, obviously. I said, well, let's go up there within the next 30 minutes. So gathered a bit of gear together, and we did, and nothing happened at all that night, but we'd got that report. He saw these things at about 5:45 on the 8th. The lady in the paper who reported to the Hull Daily Mail claims that she'd seen unusual lights. Now, they don't sound like the same thing. Her description sounds different to what Adam told me. But interesting, nevertheless, that you've got two lots of unexplained phenomena being reported. She said she'd seen them about 5:55, so you know, within 10 minutes of each other.
Well, she said around three small lights were seen flashing in the sky. She said she checked on flight radar, presumably online, to try and find out what they might be, but didn't find anything.
Yeah, well, you know, we've got lots of reports of this, and primarily they're orange over the sea off Speighton, Flamborough and Bempton, but their report prompted me to find this old report, and we got a 30-minute sighting. And once again, November the 17th. Obviously, it's not the exact date, but you know, we've got location and time frames are showing up again. And I've written down spheres off Flamborough Head, 17th of the 11th, 20. So 2 years ago, you know, 2 years and a few days. And I'm looking at this piece of paper here, people. Normally, it just comes straight out of my head, so if it sounds like I'm reading, I am. In the early hours of Tuesday morning, I received a message to my phone, which I picked up a few hours later. That's me writing that. Paul, I'm sat in the living room of my parents' home that has views over Bridlington and Flamborough. It's almost 3:30 a.m., and as I sit here looking towards Flamborough Head, I can see a row of 15 spheres of light in the sky. They are over the sea, just off the headland. Now, this is the bit with the binoculars. That's why I got mixed up. I am looking at them through my dad's high-powered binoculars, and I can see that they are oval-shaped. I can also see what looks like the same formation, which is strange, sitting on the cliffs. It's really weird. I've never seen anything like this before. And this guy watched them, Howard, for 30 minutes. We're looking at 2 years apart and
similar date.
A very similar date. And that kind of thing throws itself up more and more. There's just no end to it, Howard.
But that report from 2020 was different, because a lot of the stuff that you've reported in that area, and that, you know, going back to the 1980s, you had trawler, you know, crews reporting strange lights off that area. But these things are usually out at sea, behaving oddly, moving at different speeds, and maybe, you know, separating or going out and coming on again. But that one came, you said, didn't you, on land? There was one that was actually visible on the clifftop.
On the clifftops. But this guy, Adam, said that he could see, he said, I can see seven out at sea. And then they switched off. And then he says, I can see seven just above the clifftops at Bempton and Speighton. I received a call years ago. I think we're going back to 2009. I was sat up at Waldgate waiting. My daughter had gone to karate. And rather than drive home, take me 15 minutes to get home, I'd go and sit up there and just kill an hour, three quarters of an hour, and then go pick her up. And whilst I were out, a guy rang me up and he asked me where I was and could I get up to Buckton, which is just literally half a mile down from Speighton, and I asked him why. And I'm not saying his name, because he was poaching. And I'm not a poacher. I'm not into killing wildlife, people, so please don't think that. But he said he was up there, that's what he was doing. And he says, I'm on the clifftops. He says, and there's a series of lights. I think he said three orange lights out at sea. He says, and I don't know what I'm looking at. He said, it's really weird. And as he's talking to me, he's getting all animated. He says, they've moved. They're on top of cliffs.
Gee.
Well, this is weird. He says, I'm going. And so that's another one. So, yeah, these lights are seen in, on and around the cliffs. You know, we've got lots of reports of it. And, you know, it's strange that there's so much information. I've got lots and lots of stuff from all over the United Kingdom, but I still find a rich amount of sightings and reports coming out of this particular area. Location is key, Howard.
And it looks like it's ongoing, and it looks like you're going to get more reports. And there must be an answer to this. And I wonder if somebody somewhere, even if they're not talking about it, is trying to, maybe some scientist maybe is onto this by now. We're not going to know, are we, unless somebody tells us.
We're not.
And trying to find out what this might be.
But it has caught the attention of a lot of people. I mean, there's a scientist who's very prominent, he's not in this country, who's been in touch with me and trying to help me. Obviously, Yorkshire man, who used to knock nails in wood for a living since 16 to 48, put things over in a better light. And if I'm talking about the phenomena and talking about what we're doing, just trying to make it more pleasing on the ears of academics, because he actually has got faith in what I'm talking about, and he's had his own unusual sighting many, many years ago. So people of science are interested, without a doubt. And like I told you, like I spoke about earlier, Peter Masters, who was with me at Woolsthorpe back in 2009, that's correct, yeah, when we went and sort of sat behind the police scientific investigation van. He's got lots of electronic equipment, which we're going to be taking up onto the cliff tops. He took it up with his laptop and omnidirectional receivers and all sorts of things about 18, well, just before COVID, so it's longer than that. And we were getting unusual signals that he couldn't understand. I mean, it'd need this guy sat outside of me to talk the technical business to you guys, because I can't. I'm not fully converse with that. But we've got even more unusual phenomena picked up on his equipment, and it's really sensitive. He tells me it's the same stuff that they're using at Skinwalker, and we've picked up the 1.6 gigahertz and up at Bempton, and lots of unusual phenomena. I'll be sort of homing in on that. I like to be a bit more knowledgeable about what I'm talking about before I open my mouth.
You were saying.
No, that's all I could say on what we're going to be doing with Peter Masters.
So 1.6 gigs, I think, is sort of satellite frequency.
Okay.
That's up there. I mean, that's well beyond UHF television. People who know more about these things, my friend Ian, who worked for the BBC, will tell me more about this. But I think 1.6 gigs is an interesting frequency, because that's above standard communication.
Yeah, well, what he was also picking up on this omnidirectional receiver, we were getting the same signal, pointing it to the ground, left, right, in the air. And I'd say he'd be better talking about it than I would. And that's something that we will be discussing, and I'll be able to go with a bit more detail, be information passed on to me by an expert and not myself.
Well, interesting to get these people involved. We have to say to our listener here, who might be thinking this is all a modern phenomenon and might well go back as far as 1967 and Radio 270, perhaps, but there was very little of it. But in fact, you're very keen to tell me about pre-war sightings of huge, and I'm reading here, thank you for sending me this note, pre-war sightings of huge white cigar-shaped objects seen by fishermen off Speethan and Bempton. Pre-war,
and these are fishermen from Filey that I've got this information from, and who've seen these things and worked with people who've seen the same phenomena, if we're going to call it a phenomena, these objects, and have now passed away, and out at sea, fishing on the rocks, but mostly in boats, cobbles, crabbing, and looking for lobsters. And observed huge, like you've just said, white cigar-shaped objects over the sea off Flamborough, Speighton, Caton, Filey, just hung there, and then just suddenly just zipping away. So we're not looking at anything new here. I think it's been here long before that as well. You know, there's the ex-South African military guy who lives in Burton Fleming, and he told me an interesting report of his own, that with his wife, they visited Bempton one summer. I haven't got the date off the top of my head. Someone tells me it were about 2015. Lovely sunny day. He said lots and lots of people about, he says, and we're walking along the cliff tops and we're looking at the old RAF base. And I looked, he said, and I showed my wife. He says, and there's a very, very dark grey. It looked like a barrage balloon. It was sort of lozenger shaped. And over the base. And I just can't understand what I'm looking at. He said, it's huge, and I'm pointing it out to other people, and nobody's looking at me. Nobody's listening to us. My wife can see it. So we're trying to get the attention. I don't mean that they're within, like, tapping on the shoulder distance, but there's people about, and they're pointing to it, and nobody's bothering. So we walk up the side of the base, not on the land of the base, but within the boundaries of the RSPB, you know, the nature reserve, but it runs along the side of the base. And we carry on looking at it. For some reason, they take their eyes off it for a moment, and when they look back, it's turned bright white. and they're turning round. Is anybody else seeing this? This is a bright sunny day. Look away or turn to each other for a moment. When they look again, it's gone. He went up to the base. It's above one of the old derelict buildings, and he thought it were on a tether. That's what he was looking for, because looking for the sort of, I don't know, most plausible explanation. Looked again. It's gone from dark grey to bright white. Look again, and it's gone. What that is, I don't know. You know, it's just another quirky sighting that you don't expect. There's a lady up there who was an artist and sat painting views of the coastline. Lots of people paint up at Bempton and paint the, you know, the rock outcrops and things. And I seen a rectangle of gold light in the sky over the sea that looked like it was dripping light. So nothing conforms. Nothing's. I'm talking about the orange spheres, but there's lots and lots. There's a sort of myriad of different phenomena being reported, and there are. If they're all romancing and all lying, we only need one to be the genuine. For everybody to take this seriously. And I've no reason to believe that the people telling me these things, Howard, are lying anyway.
Well, no, you know, they're a lot of these people, professional people, and, you know, all of them, as far as I can tell from the accounts that you give, have no reason, no vested interest in wanting to, you know, spin you a yarn or extemporise or anything. And the interesting thing is, it ties into what a lot of UFO experts have told me, that quite often different people experience the same thing in different ways, or indeed some of them don't experience it at all, as you hinted. So this is a phenomenon, I think, that impacts not only your visual sense, but perhaps might also impact your mind. But again, you and I, we're not scientists. You know, we don't have all the equipment that they have. We can't know. We can only surmise.
Yeah, well, that's exactly how I would have summed it up, Howard, and you're spot on. And, you know, if we stay in Bridlington area, we've got a guy born in 1921 to 1977 called Raymond Cass. And Raymond Cass was an EVP, electronic voice phenomena expert.
I've been reading about him, Paul. He was a pioneer of EVP in this country way before anybody else was doing it.
Way before anybody. And I recommend anybody sort of look into Raymond Cass. What limited information there is online, but there is information online and from Bridlington. Absolutely amazing. But what I find fascinating is in some of his writings, he talks about the spheres of light seen over the sea in the Bay of Bridlington. So I'm not treading any new ground here. He's so forward thinking. He talks about window areas. I mean, you hear ufologists stand up at conferences now and talk about window areas. Raymond Cass were doing that in 1960s and 1970s. Window areas and being immersed in a lively magnetic flux, where primarily his area of interest was the electronic voice phenomenon. But he wasn't so close-minded that he didn't realise that other phenomena were occurring within these areas of his own interest. And, yeah, fabulous guy that absolutely underrated. The man's research, the man's name as regards ufologists, researchers of unexplained phenomena, he's left his mark, and his mark should be noted today, I think.
Well, it certainly sounds like it, and if he made recordings...
Oh, he did.
I wonder what those recordings contain. That's one for me to look into. One of the things you wanted me to talk about on this one, the Flixton Vanishing Sheep. Now, in one of our early conversations, we talked about a weird period when cats were going missing, didn't we?
Well, that's correct, yeah.
But this is something similar involving sheep in Flixton.
Yeah, and I realise sheep, so that's a bit vague because it's only one. So, you know, because it could mean a field full. But this is an engineer travelling home from work a few months ago. His wife contacted me, and he'd been staying in Scarborough all week on his engineering job, and travelled home on the night time on the Friday. And she said, he's got this straight. She rang me. She said, my husband's just, obviously she's got a vested interest in unexplained phenomena, but her husband really hasn't, or a partner. And she rang me as he said, he's just called me. I don't know the lady, by the way, but she managed to find my number and call me. Said he's just called me, and he's ever so kind of flustered and sort of bemused by what's just happened. She said he's pulled in for fuel just off the Flixton roundabout. There's a petrol station there, and just up from it, if anybody's familiar with the area, there's a chip restaurant called Harper's. Said he's just passed Harper's chip restaurant driving slowly, and he's looked to his left, and there's a field with a flock of sheep in it, and which is all perfectly normal, we know that. And then you've got the Flixton and Staxton Wold woodland behind it. So he's looking at these sheep, and there's four or five of them close to the woodline, but not right next to the fence. And what he's seen is the side-on image of a sheep, and the sheep are suddenly just as if something's grabbed hold of it, and it's just gone sideways into the woods. And he can't believe what he's looking at. It's literally as though his analogy, because I met him, this is how good I think these people are. Mm-hmm. They made the effort to drive from Leeds to meet me at the location the next day. That tells you that he's seen something unusual, because he's just done an hour and a half's drive just to tell me about what he saw and stand
you
at the location.
Do that for nothing. It sounds to me like the thing was grabbed by, the only thing I can think of is a Star Trek type tractor beam.
It's absolutely, I realise how it sounds, people. It sounds absolutely crazy, but this guy, we stood at the side of the road, we're looking up at the field, and he's describing it, and he said, if you were walking down a main street, and there's a passage off from the street, and somebody just grabbed you, and then you just went sideways off, he said it was just weird. And it passed through the fence and everything, you know, so up in the Flixton Wold, it had gone, the sheep. I did say to him that I was going to go up there and look for any signs of a carcass or anything. I haven't been yet. Time's just not allowed me to do that. But and I realise now, I don't know, 6 weeks down the line, that I've left it too late. But, you know, it's just absolutely full on at the moment. Mm. And so they weren't hollow words. I've just not managed it. So, yeah, an interesting one. So when I said of the vanishing sheep, Howard, I realise it's a bit misleading, but it was just one. But I find that fascinating.
Well, there are stories, and we've talked around some of these stories, of creatures of various kinds, mostly deer, we have to say, mutilated. Some of these things apparently picked up by something and then dropped. This sounds similar but different. We don't know what happened to that sheep. I mean, what sheep is able to almost magnetically transport itself, almost as if it was on sort of magnetic and sideways. I was going to say that.
He didn't observe the back end of the sheep, and it could have just ran head first into the woodland. It was sideways on, and it just went sideways, and it had just gone. But, you know, when I first started looking into these accounts, as I've called them, of the Flixton werewolf, and I'm not saying that's what was involved here, I'm really not. I spent a lot of time in that area, and one particular day I went up into the Flixton and Staxton Wold, which is very close to the old, it is the old RAF, radar station, but it's still operational, RAF Staxton Wold, and I'm in that woodland, me and my little dog Wolfie, and yeah, I know. He's the last thing you'd think. He's more like a hamster, people, than a wolf. But anyway, we're in there. Still day. No wind. I stress because what happened, I still can't get my head around. We were walking through these trees, and there's just three loud tree knocks at the side of me. They literally, and I'm stopped. And I'm looking, I look up at the trees and thinking, could someone be knocking up in the top, a bit of wind or something? So we sat down on a fallen tree, poured myself a coffee, flicked an Olympus recorder on, just left it rolling there for half an hour. Obviously, I know there's going to be people saying, well, you're not going to record it, are you? It knows you're there, or the phenomena, which is probably true, but you had to try. Nothing at all. So I don't know, a few months later, I went up there again. I'd been up in the meantime, but I went up there again with my granddaughter. The same area, we encountered a smell that just, it were rotten eggs, it was sulfur. absolutely intense. It was so vile that we left the area. I don't know what it signifies, people, and I don't know what the trick... Everything that I've just described could have been some kind of natural phenomenon. I understand that. But it's strange that you're getting these things coming out of a location that also produces a lot of unexplained phenomena.
Shades of Bigfoot, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Well, when I went to the Spittal Inn... because I wanted to speak to the then owners of the Spittal Inn. I wanted to look at the deeds, and they were kind enough to get the deeds and show me. And some of them were on parchment, because if anybody doesn't know what the Spittal Inn is, it's a restaurant and public house that's at the bottom of Staxton and Flixton Wold, very close to the roundabout, very close to where this sheep vanished. And the Spittal Inn is built on the foundations of a refuge that was built in 937 AD by the then King Athelstan. And it became, after the refuge sort of disbanded, a farmhouse was built on the ruins. And now it's this restaurant and public house. But I looked at these deeds because I wanted to see where it was saying that the refuge had been built to protect travellers from wolves and an infestation of savage beasts and all these sort of fabulous bits of old world terminology that people used. And it's all there. But whilst I was talking to the lady who owned the property at the time, we sat outside a lovely summer afternoon, and she's kind enough to let me look at these bits of paperwork. She said, she looked up at Flixton Wold, and I don't know why she said it. She said, "Do you know what?" She said, "I think there's a Bigfoot up there." And last thing I expected her to say, and it was last thing on my mind, because I was looking at things connected to the Flixton Werewolf. But then I was contacted by someone, probably about 4 or 5 months ago, told me that there is a book in the possession of people in, or someone in Flixton, and it's a book of werewolves, a book of reports, and it stems from a public house that used to be in Flixton and Staxton many years ago. There might be somebody in listening to this who'll be able to tell us when it stopped being a public house. It was called the Stirrup, and apparently there was a log, a book, and people had been reporting seeing this thing, or strange things that you could liken to a werewolf, for many, many years, and this book exists. So I'm still trying to get my hands on it, and I don't mean to keep it. I just want to look at it. So I've been told on good authority by two people now who've seen the book that, yeah, it is in existence. It's just whether we can get to see it, which would be interesting. It doesn't validate what these people are saying in these old bits of writing, but it just adds a little bit more meat on the bone to what I'm talking about.
Well, it shows there's been a bit of a history. Let's move on to big cats just briefly here at the end of this. One of the, I'm sure you know of him, you might know him, Rick Minter, the guy from Big Cat Conversations, regular guest on my show, very interesting man, charts big cat sightings all over the country. More and more of them, it seems, in the last year or two. It seems the big cats, you know, if they're here in numbers, they thrive during the COVID period because there was nothing to disturb them. You had one of those very recently, didn't you?
That's correct. Beginning of this month, I think it was. I ain't got exact date in front of me, Howard. But they contacted me very, very soon after they'd seen it, and they're driving... I would have thought from Bridlington. Well, I know they'd have been driving from Bridlington towards Caton, and they claimed that a puma, a huge puma, because they said it looked like size of a female lion. I don't think they're anything like that size, but they said a huge puma has just ran across the road in front of our car chasing a deer, and it's gone up the embankment. Anybody wants to Google Caton and the roundabout, and it'll be just before that. So we've got this report. What's interesting, about a mile up the road towards Bridlington, is the disused Primrose Valley holiday camp. There's another holiday camp there as well, but in a slightly different place. You know, just they're not connected anymore. So it's all overgrown, and you know, it's just disused. Guy walking through there just a few weeks before this incident claims that he saw a big cat. Unusually, this was a black one. So we've got a report of a beige puma type cat, a few weeks ago, early November. Then we've got a panther reported at the old Primrose Valley. And then across the road from Primrose Valley, there's a few bungalows, very sparse. I think they call the actual hill that these bungalows are situated on as Airy Hill. Got a report of one running across the road there. So we've three reports in close succession. That's another beige one. So we've got a black one, and the beige one could be the same, obviously. But all within a few months of each other. I think there's no doubt, as Rick Minter, he's more of the expert on this than me, there's no doubt that the cats are here. I don't think there's a mystical element to them. We know that the Wildlife Act came into force in 1976, so any cats that were released, that were illegally kept in captivity, would have long since passed away. Then I think life expectancy of a big cat anywhere is about 17 years.
But that's one of the theories, that those people who were frightened by the new law, that meant they couldn't keep exotic animals like that. And in my view, they should never have been keeping them anyway, because they wouldn't have been equipped to look after them. But, you know, some of them released them into the wild, and the theory is that over the years they've bred and spread.
Well, yeah, that's true. And just as a side note, and I'm not going to say where, but some of the American air bases that were here in the United Kingdoms, I've been told, used to keep pumas as mascots. Right. And they released them as well. Now, that's as much as I'll go into detail. I've also got information from a very, very big zoo, which we'll not say which it is, in the United Kingdom, and a former member of staff who'd worked there years, who'd give me a list of animals that have escaped, including a pack of wolves, and they only got two back.
Good Lord. And, you know, they're talking about reintroducing wolves to the north of Scotland, but to think that they might be more widespread than that, interesting?
Well, I got that bit of information a few years ago, but interestingly, there's a, up on the North Yorkshire Moors, close to Filingdales, there's a guy riding his motorbike. I might have told you this before. He's driving his motorbike early morning to go and work, I think, in Whitby. He works the dredger in Whitby, this guy. And as he's driving down past what's called, there's two pubs up on in the bleak outer nowhere, the Flask and the Falcon. I don't remember entirely which pub it was, but he just passed one of them early hours at morning, and it's just getting light, and a car's approaching him as he comes down this hill, and it's flashing its lights at him, and he's on a motorbike, and he thinks, what's happening here? Has there been an accident? I don't know. And as he rounds the bend from this steep hill that he's come down, he claims that there's two huge grey wolves sat at the side of the road upright looking at him. He takes on a freaky, a sort of bizarre kind of twist, because he said, as I passed them and I'm looking, I can't believe what I'm looking at. They weren't huskies. He says, these were huge wolves. But he says, they smiled at me. Now, I could miss people. I do realise I could miss these bits out to make the story more plausible. That, oh, yeah, there's wolves in North Yorkshire, and they're up in the North Yorkshire forests.
Maybe they were baring their teeth. Who knows?
Exactly. We've all seen dogs bare the teeth. And but the way he said it, he said they looked like they were smiling at me. So just a strange one. And but as I say, I think we're in no doubt that the cats are here, Howard. You know, there's a place in just out of Bridlington, between Bridlington and Bempton. This is where I find it gets a bit strange. And I've talked about it many times, called Short Lane. And if you go into the archives of the Bridlington Free Press, going to the library, you'll find lots of reports over spanning decades of people seeing panthers on Short Lane. It's a single track road that's about a mile long with nothing but fields either side of it. There's nothing to hide anything, yet it keeps throwing up these reports of panthers. I find that fascinating as well.
Well, as we've said before, and I think we said at the end of the last conversation we had online, you know, these people can't all be mistaken or wrong. There has to be something in all of this. I want to end on one thing, because there's a TV show, you'll know it, in this country, and I think it's exported as well, called Heartbeat. And it's all about some coppers in the north of England, some police, in an era when my dad was, you know, a young police officer. We're talking 1960s here. And it's all rather charming, and it's sort of policing rural areas. And, you know, it's your sort of area. People love it. So when I read that police at Filey, which is a very nice holiday resort, a lot of people went to holiday camps and had a nice time when they were kids at Filey. When I read that the police at Filey chased a UFO, that sort of piques my interest. What happened?
We're going back a lot of years, decades in fact, and I were told about this by the then hairdresser at Filey, who used to get the police and all manner of people coming in, and that share information with her. And on this particular occasion, the police, and I'm imagining at Filey, it's just a small seaside town. There have only been a few police officers in the town, I don't know, 1960s. That they'd chased a UFO that's in the sky in their car. They're following it through the town during the night, and lots of sort of excitement in the radio room regarding this. But then there's a large tank. I don't know what they're called that contained the gas, the huge steel gas tanks that you can still see in all over the place. You know, I think you know what I'm on about, Howard, don't you? And
I like think they call them gasometers, didn't they?
Gasometer. Okay, I'm glad you knew that.
I think they did. I mean, somebody's going to correct me. But
as they're chasing this thing, or they're in pursuit, they're following it, I should imagine, rather than chasing it. After all, it is in the air. It literally flies into the side of what you've just called the gasometer.
Gee.
But left no mark. It just literally went into it, and that was the last they'd ever seen of it. Which is a strange one in itself. But we wouldn't be dealing with unexplained phenomena if it wasn't strange. And interestingly, just briefly, you talk about the programme Heartbeat, and they're filming in a place called Gothland. And Gothland is only a few miles away, from where we've been filming Wolfland, where the reports of the cryptids. Well, Gothland has its own legend of a huge bipedal hound called the Guy Trash. And I don't think it can all be coincidence that these things that are from folklore and from our ancient past are still being reported in present day, just the different names. Very close to Gothland, very close to Broxah Forest, is a place called East Heighton. In East Heighton, 120 years ago, there was a writer called Howard Brealey who wrote about the Barguest of East Heighton, a huge bipedal hound. The same things that we're reporting today from our witnesses in present day were being seen hundreds of years before us. We're not treading new ground.
So, Paul, you know, we think we're too cool for school these days and we know everything. What you're proving every time we talk is that we don't. When's the documentary out, Paul? Have you got a rough estimate?
Well, I bet people are sick of hearing me, Howard. But, you know, it's been a long haul, but we're really pleased with it. And it's off to have its music added by Mick Park and tomorrow, all being well. So we shouldn't be long after that. I mean, we've done all we can do on it. We'll probably have another afternoon on it before it goes. But basically, yeah, it's off to have music added, and then we shall be looking at getting it released and getting it out there for people to see. And the proof will be in the pudding, whether we've produced something good or mediocre. My own feeling is it's absolutely brilliant.
My feeling too, Paul. Thank you very much indeed. What's your website so people can check you out?
Truthproof.uk. And the books, paperback books, are available on there, and the Kindle books are available on Amazon. And Howard, as always, thank you.
No, thank you, Paul. I'm really pleased at how it's all going. Thank you again. Another successful appearance for Paul Sinclair. My thanks to him. As ever, he will reappear on The Unexplained. More great guests in the pipeline here at the home of The Unexplained. So until next we meet, my name is Howard Hughes. This has been The Unexplained Online. And please, whatever you do, please stay safe. Please stay calm. And above all, please stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.